And hello and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and the show, as usual, features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guest is Dennis Palumbo. He's been on before. I'd love to have him on the show. He's a writer whose work includes many TV shows, the feature film My Favorite Year, for which he was nominated for a Writers Guild of America Award for Best Screenplay, novels, articles, and the book Writing from the Inside Out, published by John Wiley and Sons. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, Barbara. How are you doing?
Good.
Thanks for having me back.
Oh, it's always great to talk to you. I mention you quite a bit in my class. Often I'll play an excerpt from a show, a past show that you've been on.
Mm-hmm.
And my students always love hearing how actually you segued from writing to being a therapist who deals a lot with a lot of creative problems of writers and others in L.A.
Well, it's an interesting story, but I'll give you the two-minute version, which is essentially that I had been a film and TV writer for about 17 years, and as you say, I did a lot of work in film later, but I started in television on Welcome Back, Cotter, and I wrote the first episode of Love Boat and a few other things. This was way back in the 70s, and after about 17 years, I was in personal therapy myself and really just fell in love with doing it and as a patient. And so while I was still writing screenplays, I went back to school at night, and over a six-year period, I decided to go for my license and become a psychotherapist, which I managed to do. And I've been in private practice now about 17 years also, almost equal amount of time. And I still write prodigiously, but I write in prose. I'm retired from film and television, but I write articles and book reviews and even just finished a novel. And my practice is primarily with creative people. I have writers primarily, but I have actors, directors, musicians. For some reason, in the last year or two, I've had a number of composers, which is kind of new for me. but I guess because I'm here in Los Angeles and because of my background in the entertainment industry, I've drawn a lot of creative people into my practice.
Interesting. Now, is there a main problem or a couple of problems that writers seem to always bring to you?
Well, I would say probably the two most significant problems that writers bring in. Number one would be writer's block, or even procrastination. They're kind of versions of each other. And secondly, the struggle to maintain your sense of ambition and belief in yourself in the face of the pragmatic difficulties of trying to be a writer. You know, whether it's your relationship or financial or child rearing or, you know, nowadays ageism, you know, I mean, it's very, very tough. And whether you write prose or whether you work in script form, it's a very demanding marketplace. And I never think a commercial marketplace has ever been very kind to artists on the whole. But to maintain your sense of belief in yourself, your sense of mission, and to sort of stay, you know, on the beam in terms of what you want and require in the face of, you know, the realities of making a living and caring for your family. So, you know, on the pragmatic side, it would be the latter. On the creative side, I would say writer's block and procrastination.
I'm talking with Dennis Palumbo, author of Writing from the Inside Out, published by John Wiley. Sounds like there's a crisis going down your street.
Well, you know, I'm right here in Sherman Oaks at the corner of Ventura and Sepulveda, and about every hour, I think because it's so ideally located, some fire truck comes screaming by.
I'm curious whether the things you hear from writers are similar to other art forms. For instance, are other types of artists as, discouraged about getting their work out there or somewhat hopeless as writers. I find writers do an awful lot of disclaiming. You know, they have to say how bad something is before they read it, say, in class. And it seems for some reason writers are very trained to think poorly of what they're producing.
Well, I've thought about that a little bit. Even though obviously painters and musicians and even, you know, sculptors and, you know, film directors all make use of who they are and how they feel to create their art, I think no one does that with more particular personal relevance than writers. And as a result, I think when a writer is about to stand up and read his or her material, I can't think of any art form other than perhaps acting in which you feel so personally exposed.
Mm-hmm.
I used to teach actors. When I was a screenwriter, I also had an acting class that I taught. And I used to just marvel at the vulnerability that actors would show because they risk personal rejection every time they do an audition. But it's only slightly better for a writer. I mean, every time a writer produces a piece of work, they risk what I call shameful self-exposure, that they're not as creative and talented and smart as they think they are. And not only do they fear that they'll hear that from an editor or from a writing teacher or from a producer or a potential agent, remember, when they're typing it on their screen, they're reading it themselves. They're their first critic. And most people have such a powerful inner critic that they often invalidate the value of what they're doing even as they're creating it. And so I think because writers mine the personal experiences within themselves, you know, the raw materials for a painter is a palette full of paints, and you throw them up on the wall. Raw materials for a sculptor is you get a bunch of marble and you start chipping away. The raw material for a writer is what happened to him when his parents got divorced.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from inside himself or herself. And to write something that is powerful and that speaks to people, paradoxically, requires that it be personal. You know, one of the paradoxes of writing, I think I may have mentioned this before on your show, is that the more personal and idiosyncratic it is to you, the more it generalizes out to everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't have to have been poor and Irish and growing up in Dublin to be moved by Angela's Ashes.
Yes.
You don't have to ever have stepped into a boxing ring to know what Rocky Balboa thought when he said, I have to do this so that I know I'm not a bum. I mean, everyone knows what it's like to put themselves on the line, to risk when they don't feel like risking, to push past their comfort zone. And for writing to speak to us, the writer has to mine his or her own experiences. That's an incredibly brave and incredibly vulnerable thing to do. And I think, like I said, next to acting, I don't know anything that's as potentially exposing as being a writer. And I think that's why writers are so struggle so hard and fear so much when they're about to show their material.
And then, okay, so writers, genre. Now, are novelists more upset than, say, journalists, or poets more distraught than novelists? I mean, do you see any difference in the genre of writing then?
Well, it depends. I mean, I sort of always joke around and say, you know, the unhappiest writers in my practice are screenwriters, and then I go down from there. you know, novelists are, I think, feel in many ways the most empowered among the patients that I see because they create entire worlds. And we live in a time now where if a publisher buys your novel, they hardly edit it. You're lucky if they even read it. You know, they pretty much, they're acquisition editors now, so it's not like they're going to sit down with you like Max Perkins did with Thomas Wolfe and say, okay, page one.
Yeah.
They're not going to do that. If they buy the book, it's, other than spelling mistakes and syntax mistakes, they're pretty much going to print it. Poets, I don't know, my experience with poets is they feel holier than thou because they're all starving. You know, you can't make much of a living as a poet. And so they're always worried about money. But in terms of the purity of their work, most poets feel quite good about what they're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, as I say, screenwriters who often feel, because of the financial requirements of the marketplace, often quite removed from the very thing that inspired them to become a writer many years before.
Hmm. Now, I would have thought that novelists would be some of the most discouraged.
It depends. They're discouraged if they're genre novelists, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
An agent and writer named Don Moss has written a book called The Career Novelist.
Sure.
And, you know, as he explains, if you write a continuing character, you can make a nice living. Your audience knows what to expect. You create a brand for your name. If you are a literary writer and you write novels, the odds go way, way down, particularly in today's marketplace. So they're very, very frustrated. So I think that it's hard. The easiest is the wrong word, but the most... the type of writing that New York publishers tend right now to be the most interested in is creative nonfiction,
mm-hmm.
particularly narrative nonfiction.
Mm.
You know, books like The Devil in the White City or A Civil Action, wherein true events are dramatized with a strong narrative form, using the conventions of novel writing,
mm-hmm.
suspense, and characterization and surprise and reversal and all of those things. That's the most popular type of book.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Then, you know, it makes me think of trends. And when you hear of something that perhaps might be what publishers are looking for, you decide that's what you're going to write. But then by the time you're finished...
Yeah, that's a tremendous mistake. I remember hearing somebody... I was at some conference or something, and I heard some agent say, well, you know, if you're going to be writing a thriller, man, think Da Vinci Code.
Mm-hmm.
And see, what I always say to people when they ask me is the last thing in the world you want to do is write something like that now.
Yeah.
Because 3 years from now, publishers will have 700,000 manuscripts that are like that.
Mm-hmm.
And something small and very, very different, a little cozy mystery like an Agatha Christie mystery, might be number one on the, you know, bestseller list. So I always think it's a mistake to chase after bestseller lists. It's just a foolish mistake. And I think for screenwriters, in my experience, it's a mistake as well. Your best bet is to really write what is meaningful and true for you and hope you can get other people to agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I really think you just have to keep giving them you until you is what they want.
Right. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Dennis Palumbo, who is author of Writing from the Inside Out, published by Wiley. He's also a therapist in Los Angeles dealing with creative challenges that creative people are facing. What about finishing things? I think earlier you mentioned something about procrastination.
Mm-hmm.
Finishing things seems to be problematic to a lot of, especially new writers.
Oh, yes.
And they sometimes find it really hard to lasso that desire to, once they start, to actually finish.
Yeah, there's a couple things in my experience that go hand in hand with concerns about finishing. I would guess overall, the biggest thing is the fact that when something is finally done, it's going to go out and be evaluated. And that's when our insecurities and self-doubts, you know, really come to the fore, where there's the potential for exposure is very great. And secondly, I think that many starting writers have a kind of perfectionist tendency, the fear that if they don't keep working on something, they won't make it perfect enough that it will be criticism-proof, if you know what I mean. And the reality is, as I've gotten older, I really learned you never finish a piece of writing. You just abandon it. You know, you can write the end on it. But when I look at something I've written years ago, I always want to rewrite it, even if it's been published.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that's a bad thing, because people grow. And every writer I know looks back on something, regardless on how of how well received, and says, "Boy, I think I could have made chapter three a little stronger by cutting it or doing something else." And so I think you have not only the fear of it going out into the marketplace, and then you having to sustain and tolerate the criticism, but also the concern of, I mean, I traditionally, for me, when I was a screenwriter, I would rewrite and rewrite and never hand the thing in because, you know, they would never love it enough, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, I was so laboring under all the injunctions I had when I was young that everything had to get an A. And so I just would work it and work it and work it until, you know, the agent would call me and say, "You've got to hand it in now," you know, and I'd hand it in and just, you know, put my head under the covers and wait to hear what they said.
Mm-hmm.
At a deeper level, I think writers have a hard time finishing because when you have an idea or you have a burst of inspiration, you know, you start typing and you're writing in longhand and you're excited. Writing is a craft and it is not a sprint. It's a marathon. It's a long process. Writing a screenplay or a novel or a nonfiction book or even a long essay or article takes sustained effort and diligence. And sometimes you have to write when you're not really sure that what you're doing is the right thing or whether you're going in the right direction. And I think writers who are new get very discouraged that these feelings have a particular meaning. They mean that what you're doing doesn't work, or that it's never going to turn out well, or you shouldn't have started it in the first place. You know, it's like walking into a haunted house. The deeper you get into it and the darker it gets, the more you think the whole idea of going in there was a bad idea. And I think that's the way it is for a lot of new writers. And the shock for new writers is something that I tell them all the time, because I have many veteran writers in my practice, and they struggle in exactly the same way that new writers do. The only difference is the long-term veteran professional writers don't think that those struggles mean anything. They don't think it means they're not really a good writer or they should give it up and go fold sweaters at Banana Republic. They don't think it means the story's bad or that they'll never solve their problems. Veteran writers know that the problems you have writing something are inherent in how difficult it is to write anything well.
Hmm. Well, I love this quote at the beginning of your book, of the first chapter. A writer is someone for whom writing is more difficult than it is for other people.
Yeah, Thomas Mann, yeah.
Talk about that, because, you know, I think especially new writers think you're supposed to be inspired all the time.
Yeah, well, before I even talk about the Mann quote, I have to, unfortunately, debunk inspiration. I know this is going to sound terrible, but I think the concept of inspiration does writers a real disservice. I remember one time reading an interview with Mary Chase, who wrote Harvey, you know, the play.
Sure.
And someone said, "Where did you get the idea for Harvey?" And she said, "Well, I looked up from the breakfast table one morning, and there he was." And see, I always want to run over writers like that with a truck. You know, I don't believe in inspiration. I think that the concept of you know, sitting around a room and being inspired, like a beam of light coming in, does a disservice to writers because they instantly assume that the people who are smarter or more graced by God get these great inspirations and that the rest of the people don't. And so if you're not inspired, there's something wrong with you. I think inspiration, because it cannot be grasped, it cannot be, you know, brought up on command, makes you crazy and makes you feel inadequate. What I think writers should do instead is cultivate imagination, which everybody has in abundance. Everybody has imagination. I mean, you walk down the street and you see someone, you go, "Gee, I wonder, you know, what their wife looks like," or "Gee, I wonder what he does for a living." And then you could say to yourself, "Well, he could be a spy. What do I know?" And so your imagination takes flight. And I think that if we had more confidence that cultivating our imagination and marrying it to the feelings that we've had all of our life based on how we were raised and how the world seems to us, then we have something to say. Our imagination will give us a vehicle to put all of our feelings and desires in. And so I think in that regard, I'd much rather cultivate my imagination tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. than hope when I get there at 9 a.m. that I'm going to be inspired. That, I mean, my writing just doesn't need the pressure, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that said, I think in terms of the quote about how it's more difficult for writers than for other people, well, it's the same as it's more difficult for Yo-Yo Ma to play the cello than for some guy doing it in his basement.
Mm-hmm.
Because for writers, writing is the expression of their art. It is, for many of them, the number one ingredient of their self-concept. Doing it well reflects on their ambition and their talent and their craft. For the average person, writing a letter to someone has no meaning because they go, they're just going to impart information and say how they feel and then, you know, write "Love, Beverly," and they're done. But a writer cannot do that because every time a writer puts pen to paper or sends an op-ed piece into the LA Times, he or she is making an announcement. I am putting out what I think and feel into the common discourse of the marketplace in a form that everyone recognizes, which means it's going to be evaluated, which means I'm going to be evaluated.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very, very difficult. The average person writes their note to Aunt Betty, and no one else but Aunt Betty is going to see it. When you or I write an editorial, 5 million Aunt Bettys are going to read it. So it's going to be much harder for us than it is for the average person.
Yeah. Well, we have much more to talk about, and we're going to take a very short break and be right back with more Dennis Palumbo. So all you out there, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Hello and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I should say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guest and not those of the University of California Regents. And I also want to tell you again that we have begun to podcast and archive shows. So if you go to my website at penonfire.com, click on the radio tower on the left of your screen. It will take you to the radio page, the homepage for the radio show. The right side of that screen, it's pretty apparent. It says listen live or archive. It says something like that. You click on that link and you can pick up the podcast. You can listen to the archives. iTunes also has free software for your PC or your Mac, and there's a link to get that software there. And then you can listen to podcasts. We pretty much post one every week. Soon we'll probably post more than one because I have 8 years worth of shows that we'd like to get on there. So in any case, we're here today with Dennis Palumbo. He has been with us since 5 o'clock, and we're going to continue. Hi there.
How you doing?
I am good, and I have so much more I want to talk to you about. What about when you're a professional writer and you start feeling that your work is lackluster? You may be selling, you may, you know, be fine in terms of what others are thinking, but in terms of what you yourself are thinking about your writing, you're just kind of unenthused. I mean, is there ever a time you should just go on to something new so you can become excited again?
Well, it depends. I've had, you know, over the years, you know, dozens and dozens of patients who've presented with something like this. And you would be surprised at some of the most successful and people you would know, writers who feel like their work has become derivative of themselves, stale, repetitive. And there's a couple things you can do. Number one, I think you can help them. Let me put it this way. Rather than putting it in a therapeutic context, let me just put it for the average listener. You can ask yourself, are you still as excited about writing as you were before? Can you remember or get in contact with the things that made you want to be a writer in the first place? The second thing you can do, which is much more dangerous, is to look at the stuff you've never written about. More personal stuff, more relational material, more political material, more controversial, more provocative material that you've traditionally shied away from either by habit or by choice.
Hmm.
And that maybe it's time, you don't have to show this to anyone right away,
mm-hmm.
to do this. And I have this happening right now with a writer who's been quite successful writing romantic comedy screenplays, and she's been doing them for years, and she's gotten kind of tired of writing these kinds of things because often, you know, for your standard Hollywood movie, they are fairly cookie cutter.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, you know, when you look at the movie trailer, you kind of know where the movie's going, and so she was really kind of burnt out on doing them, and I talked about things that had gone on in her childhood and her life and stuff. And one of the things that we discovered was that much of the way in which she wrote was a way to create a fantasy that was very unlike the life that she had experienced growing up in her family. And now she's writing a very powerful play about that material and totally re-engaged with writing, totally revitalized.
Hmm.
And the thing that I've discovered is it doesn't mean like that she would necessarily not go back to continuing to write romantic comedies.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that we have to remember that any part of us that's unintegrated, any part of us that's unexplored, any interest or memory or feeling that has been sequestered, either because we're afraid of it or because we just got too busy in doing our lives to really go visit it very much, it's going to be knocking at the door sometime, 2 o'clock in the morning or when you least expect it. And it's going to say, I want to be heard from. I want to express my truth as well. And I think most writers grow significantly when they visit those parts of themselves. And it doesn't always mean that the public is going to respond. I always think of the famous example of John le Carré, when he, after enormous success with 3 or 4 of his spy novels in a row, published a non-spy novel. And I read it. I thought it was quite good. And none of his fans bought this book. But his work improved enormously after that, I thought, and deepened in richness. And another example is Woody Allen, whose comedies, his early comedies, came to a screeching halt when he made this drama called Interiors, which everyone climbed all over and criticized and stuff. But following Interiors, he made Annie Hall in Manhattan and Hannah and Her Sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he couldn't have made those deeper, richer comedies without having made a left turn into Bergman territory for
mm-hmm.
a movie. So I think that in my experience with my writer patients, they get revitalized when they explore material that has been shunted to the side on their way to developing the style and the content and the genre that has now become successful for them.
Hmm. Well, speaking of style, I forget who it is that said, if you want to change your writing style, change your life.
I don't remember who said that either.
What do you think, though? I mean, do you think that's a valid statement or a useful statement?
Well, my only problem is, I mean, I'm sure it could be. I'm sure there's some value in it. My problem is it's all external. It's like, you know, saying if you want to be more attractive to people, get a nose job. I mean, I think it's too external. When someone says, you know, I'm not satisfied with my writing style, I would go directly opposite and say, whose writing styles do you admire? And they'll come in and list five or six writers whose styles they admire, and I'll go, what makes them all unique is that these writers are very much in touch with their own inner worlds and are writing in voices that express those inner worlds. And if you are dissatisfied with your style, the way you need to change your life is not to necessarily pull up stakes and go move to Montana, but instead ask yourself which parts of your own interior worlds are you not expressing. You know, I've often had writers whose natures or whose personalities seem to me are like acerbic and funny and bitter and wry, and yet their writing is often very straight ahead and conventional. And when they complain about style, I'll often say, you know, the person who's talking to me right now, I don't hear that voice in your writing.
Mm-hmm. So do you think we should write like we talk?
No, not necessarily. I think that it's not about, style is not about writing the way you speak. You know, as Hemingway said, good dialogue is not real speech, it's the
mm-hmm.
illusion of real speech.
Sure.
And I don't think that Hemingway spoke the way he wrote. And I don't think, Elmer Leonard talks the way he writes. The style is the combination, I think, of your intellect and the way in which your personality inside you needs to express itself.
Mm-hmm.
We are all in our, I think everyone has sort of operatic passions. I think everyone is sarcastic and funny and sexy and violent and interesting and rueful and nostalgic. But when we're working behind the counter at Baskin and Robbins, we have very little likelihood of being able to access any of that stuff in our daily life. Writers can do that. Writers can be all of those things.
You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I am with Dennis Palumbo, author of Writing from the Inside Out, published by Wiley. What about, you know, the challenge of writing what you love versus writing what will sell? Now, of course, you can write what you love and it does sell, but often if somebody's working on a novel, say, they're a lot less encouraged about selling it than, say, a nonfiction project.
Right.
Yet the novel is the thing, perhaps, that they really want to do. How do you reckon that?
You're not lobbing any of the softballs to me tonight. My God! I don't know. I mean, no, I'm teasing. The thing is, that question literally comes up here once a week in my office. And it's as true for prose writers as it's true for screenwriters and television writers. It has always been true. No matter how much writers complain about the demands of the marketplace, it has always been the dilemma of artists that how do I reconcile what it is I want and what the public wants? I mean, Shakespeare had that problem. Every writer has that problem. Most of the time, what I suggest is if you can do it, write what you love and do it enough and keep giving them you until you is what they want.
Mm-hmm.
But we live in the real world. If you're going to write a screenplay that's 350 pages long about what you eat for dinner every night, no one's going to buy it.
Right.
Now, if you feel really compelled that your growth as a writer requires that you do that, I say go ahead. But if your goal is to write a screenplay that Paramount's going to make, then maybe you should go look at the movies Paramount's been making recently and then say to yourself, what kind of film could I write that takes into account me and what interests me and yet has enough commercial viability that someone else might be interested in doing it? I mean, I read a wonderful novel recently that I love called Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a first-person narrative written in from the point of view of an autistic child.
Sure.
Boy, I don't know what the story was in getting that book sold, but that has non-commercial written all over it,
mm-hmm.
and it was wonderful.
Yes.
And so whenever someone says, well, look at the bestseller charts and look at, you know, go to Barnes & Noble and see what's selling, that's true up to a point. And yet I recall very clearly the year in which on the New York Times bestseller list, Angela's Ashes was the number one book in the nonfiction list, a book by an unknown, and Cold Mountain by Charles Frazier was the number one book on the fiction bookseller
yes.
list.
Yeah.
Another book by an unknown, neither one of which were genre books, were in any way like books that had been bestsellers the previous 5 years. I mean, books that violated every one of those rules. And so I think the best you can do is try to keep one eye on the marketplace so that you feel pragmatic enough that agents and editors will talk to you. But ultimately know that it's the originality that you bring that's going to make the difference. I mean, I've used this example on your show before, Barbara, but it's still true. If you're a struggling writer and you go out and buy one of those books on how to write a screenplay, and you follow all the rules that say, well, your hero has to show up on page 3, and his first dilemma has to appear on page 10, and the act 1 break is on page 30, and you follow those rules and write a screenplay, and you give it to an agent. Well, agents go home every weekend with about 35 scripts, and I guarantee you the writers of every one of those scripts has their hero come in on page 3 and the first incident on page 10 and the act 1 break on page 30, and the agent only responds to one of those scripts. Why? Because of the writing.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
You see what I mean? So I think that that has a lot to do with it.
What is that?
That is my cell phone, which I will pick up after this is over.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Dennis Palumbo. We have a little bit of time left. Well, earlier you said you were saying something that prompted me to make a note to myself to ask you about something we've talked about before, which is writing about people you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, writing about your family, writing about someone who may end up getting upset at you for writing about them.
Oh, yes.
What about that? What do you do? I mean, there's legal concerns, of course, but I guess I'm talking more about the psychological concerns.
Well, the psychological concerns are deep. I mean, there's a couple ways to go. I mean, my goodness. I mean, whenever a writer is going to write about their family or personal events or things that happened, I always caution them, you know, look at why you're doing it and ask yourself, are you willing to take the heat of being really specific? I think that if what you need to say can be conveyed in a way that protects their identities, you might be better off doing that. And you also want to be very clear as a writer that writing is not something you're supposed to use to get back at or get even with or to tell your version of the story, because that is not really what writing does. That's not its goal. That's certainly not its aesthetic or artistic goal. And so I think that it's real important that you consider what the impact of this is going to be on the people who are going to be reading it. Hmm. And yet many writers, I mean, I was thinking of Catherine Harrison's The Kiss.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of don't care. They just decide they'll take the heat. I have a patient, a couple years ago, I had a patient who wrote a memoir in which she named names and had a grueling couple months, and including family members who to this day don't speak to her. But she felt compelled to tell her truth. I think some of that could have been done a little differently, and I think some of the motives were a little suspect.
Hmm.
But everyone has a right to decide how much of that they're going to do. I know in my own case, for example, I had a lot of really fascinating experiences as a child working in my father's grocery store. I had a little mom-and-pop grocery store, and all my relatives and the friends that came, and quite evocative of the period in the 50s, of a type of store that just really doesn't exist anymore. I'll feel more comfortable when my parents pass away to write that story.
Mm-hmm.
That's just personal to me.
What about, rather than doing a memoir, doing something fictional?
I think that's the best way to do it. And I think it for two reasons. Number one, I think you eliminate some of the anguish that may come to family members and to yourself. And secondly, to be honest with you, it's fiction anyway. I think our memory of things is so colored by our subjective impressions. I mean, if you think of, let's say, a fight you had with your best friend 20 years ago, and you decide you want to write that down, and she read it later, she might say, it didn't happen that way at all. So the reality is, the moment you begin writing your memories, you're fictionalizing them based on the way you're punching up those memories. So you might as well fictionalize it anyway. And secondly, to meet the demands of narrative, you're going to have to change it. In other words, in our own lives, most of the conflicts and events that have happened to us have ended kind of raggedly or not ended at all or ended in very ambivalent ways. But for dramatic purposes, they've got to end very cleanly and clearly. There's got to be a denouement, a catharsis. So you're already fictionalizing it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look, for example, at Seabiscuit, and it's very moving when the Jeff Bridges character loses his son and sort of adopts that young jockey as a sort of surrogate son. In real life, he had more than one child. But for the purpose of fiction, it's much more powerful and dramatic if he loses his one child.
Mm.
But in real life, that guy had other children.
Mm-hmm.
Writers do that all the time, because their goal is what suits the dramatic purpose of the story. So in that regard, I think you're just as well to create fictionalized accounts that speak to what you remember as the emotional truth of the experience, as opposed to some false idea of staying faithful to what you remember to be the content truth,
yes,
when in fact it's just your memory after all.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, what are you reading right now?
Gosh, I just was finishing Devil in the White City, and I'm about to start a book called A History of God by Karen Armstrong.
Mm-hmm.
And the novel that I just finished was The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime,
yes,
which I liked very much.
Yes, interesting. Any advice for the writers listening?
The best advice I can give you is that writing begets writing. I have so many patients who spend a lot of time bitching and moaning to their friends that they should be writing, or go to Starbucks and spend an hour complaining about the fact that they're not writing. Writing begets writing. Every hour you spend writing badly is an hour you didn't spend sitting around thinking about what you should have been writing.
Mm-hmm.
Talkers talk, writers write. And I think on the whole, even if you think that you need to struggle with problems by thinking about them, most writers write their way out of their problems, not think their way. So I trust the dialogue between you and your text. I think writers solve their problems by writing, and they write more by writing than by thinking about writing or planning to write. And so it's real blue collar. I don't know whether it's because my dad had that grocery store and I'm just a middle-class Italian kid from Pittsburgh, but I'm very blue collar about writing. I think you sit down, you put your butt in the chair, and you write. And if it's good, great. And if it's bad, tomorrow's another day.
Yes. Well, thank you, Dennis, again, for coming on
the show.
Oh,
it's my pleasure.
And I'm sure we'll be talking again.
I'm sure we will, too. Thank you so much for having me on.
You're welcome.
Take care.
That was Dennis Palumbo, author of Writing from the Inside Out. He was speaking to us from Los Angeles, from the corner of some street in Sherman Oaks, where his office is, and fire trucks go by every hour. If you would like to know more about Writers on Writing, you can visit my website, which is penonfire.com, and click on the radio tower. It'll take you to the radio page, and I promise to update it in the next couple of days. I don't think all the current guests for the rest of this month and the new year are on my schedule, but they will be in the next day or so. You can subscribe to my email list if you want me to shoot you out an email every Thursday morning telling you who's going to be on the show. You can do that there. And we're podcasting, as I said, and archiving shows, which you can get to on that page as well. So I think I'm going to leave you with a quote by, from the Talmud, and it's from Dennis's book, and it goes like this. It is not your obligation to complete your work, but you are not at liberty to quit. Okay. Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.